This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
42% of the population, or 20 million people, are now facing acute hunger. Do not know where their next meals come from. And of those, 6.3 million people are in emergency levels of hunger, which is just one step away from famine.
That's Lenny Kinzili, spokesperson for the World Food Program in Sudan, on how the hunger situation continues to worsen with the conflict there now in the seventh month. Details coming up also. South Africa says it could help mediate an end to the conflict between Israel and Hamas. And we hear about the reaction of Arab governments to the conflict. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Aid trucks are expected to start arriving in Gaza from Egypt in the next days. Israel cut off flows of food, fuel, medicines, and power to Gaza's 2.2 million residents last week after Hamas militants assaulted Israeli communities, killing about 1,400 people and taking more than 200 hostages. Since then, Israel has bombarded Gaza, which Hamas governs, with missiles and airstrikes. Officials in Gaza today said more than 3,700 Palestinians, most of them women and children, have died and more than 12,000 injured. Shortly after midnight today, U.S. President Joe Biden arrived home from spending 7 hours in the Israeli war zone. His visit followed several days of intense diplomacy in the Middle East by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Later today, Biden will address the nation on the U.S. response to the Hamas attacks. To update us on the administration's efforts in the conflict, we have standing by VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, returning to the U.S., Biden told reporters on Air Force One he was satisfied he got the job done. Cindy, was he talking about the issue of unblocking humanitarian aid to besieged Gaza?
Yes, I think you hit it right on the nail there, that was his main mission, was the plight, as you mentioned, of some 2.2 million people in Gaza. And right after he met with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, Netanyahu came out and announced that Israel would not block international humanitarian aid coming in from Egypt, but made clear that if Hamas intercepts the aid, then that would be stopped, and it would be another indication that Hamas leaders don't care about their people. So I think that was the major thing that President Biden was aiming at, and he explained that some roads had been, bombed and needed to be patched, and that if all goes well and according to plan, the first trucks will start rolling Friday to provide some much-needed water, food, and fuel for Palestinians who, as you said, have been cut off and trapped.
So the aid should be coming, the convoys should be coming from the, they'll be entering Gaza from Egypt's Rafah border crossing?
Correct. Exactly right. All eyes are on that, and it has not started happening yet, but we're expecting that the president is going to speak directly to the American people, as you mentioned, Thursday evening, talking about that, saying that the U.S. doesn't want any civilians to suffer, probably again making clear that Hamas does not speak for all Palestinians, and saying that the U.S. really wants to help the people there. And the president is also expected to make a case, again, directly to the American people, that the U.S. needs to fund Israel, needs to keep funding Ukraine, and fund Taiwan, and the situation at the border with Mexico. And the president, I think, hopes to roll everything into one and ask for $100 billion in resources from the U.S. Congress, hoping that although there's, you know, some Republican resistance to keeping up aid to Ukraine, that there's broad, widespread support for Israel, and that aid to Ukraine could kind of get bundled up with the aid to Israel.
And Cindy, you're right when you said the president drew a firm distinction between Palestinian people and their radical Hamas rulers, whom he accused of using civilians as human shields. But he also pleaded with Israel leaders not to allow the rage over the killings to blur the clarity over their objectives in trying to destroy Hamas.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And probably some of your listeners saw those pictures of Biden being embraced by Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. And I think it took this personal visit at this time to win those concessions. And I think it was a very personal appeal from Biden saying, look, you know, I know what happened to you. It feels like what happened to the U.S. on September 11th. And I understand the rage, but don't let yourself be consumed by rage. Take deliberate action and please spare civilians.
And I'm curious, Cindy, did that blast at the Gaza hospital overshadow Biden's trip to Israel? It also sparked protests in multiple Arab nations.
Yes. Well, depending on whom you ask and talk to, it certainly did the blast, terrible loss of life, and it scuttled President Biden's plans to meet with the Palestinian Authority president and the Egyptian president. And although Palestinian Authority President Abbas did meet sort of privately without any cameras with Secretary Blinken, who was still in the region. But it was a different visit. It wasn't what Biden had planned. But I think that the president probably understood that with the anger that you're talking about that is on the streets in some of these countries, in Jordan and other Arab countries, that it wasn't the moment where they wanted to be, you know, photographed embracing the American president.
And lastly, what do you anticipate from Biden's address to the nation today?
Right. Well, as we discussed a little bit, I think that the main thing is going to be an appeal to the American people and basically, you know, going through the American people to get to Congress to support, saying that this is a matter of what's going on now in Israel and what's happening in Ukraine is a matter of U.S. national security. The State Department has raised the worldwide terror alert. So I expect Biden to say this is a real inflection point. This is not time for the U.S. to walk away.
VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain, welcome. Thank you for your input.
Thank you so much.
Anti-Israeli protests have flared across the Middle East and North Africa as the leaders of some Arab countries condemned Israeli following an explosion believed to have killed hundreds of people sheltering at a hospital in Gaza City. The Israeli Defense Forces say they did not cause the blast and claim it was the result of a failed rocket launch by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Thousands of protesters shouting anti-Israeli slogans have gathered in Lebanon, Iraq, Jordan, Kuwait, Egypt, and Tunisia. Protests also rocked the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. Arab governments that have normalized relations with Israel were criticized for not protesting the Israeli bombardment of Gaza in response to Hamas militants attacking Israeli communities on October the 7th. Khalil Jashan, executive director of the Arab Center in Washington, discussed the Arab reaction to the war with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
Israel was definitely shocked by this incident on October 7th. So did the United States. But frankly, I believe that Arab parties to this normalization with Israel were also equally shocked. I think they're worried that their street, their citizens, the Arab masses, that scientifically have shown in the past through public opinion surveys that we have conducted at the Arab Opinion Index and others have established that the majority of Arabs in some countries like Algeria, it's 99%. In some countries like Saudi Arabia, it's close to, let's say, 70% do oppose normalization with Israel. So Arab governments are a bit apprehensive, and therefore they were paralyzed politically to react to this situation. I think their streets and their citizenry speaks louder. They are very clear in terms of sympathy with the Palestinians. We're talking about an Arab population where 90% in some countries tell you that essentially Palestine is not the cause of just the Palestinian people. It is their cause also. So this deadly kind of quiet that we have witnessed over the past 10, 11 days is not a surprise. These governments have basically gambled their own future as regimes on their normalized relations with Israel, and they're afraid right now to rock the boat with detrimental results to their own national security.
But could the bombardment of a Palestinian hospital produce some sort of international community and UN pressure on Israel to restrain?
I'm sure it could. I mean, all these scenarios are possible. Israel has not faced that type of pressure recently. And the current government in Israel is not known for its moderation or its sensitivity to regional or international public pressure, if you will. And so it's kind of hard to come up with a definitive answer to these questions. But no country is immune to pressure from the outside. This has happened already in this crisis and will continue to happen. As a matter of fact, President Biden, in his own kind of limited understanding of this issue, himself was promising to use the trip not just to encourage Israel and to express support for Israel, which he has declared that is as his number one objective, but also to raise some issues with Israel. Particularly the last couple of days, he's been dwelling on the fact essentially that Israel should not occupy Gaza. Otherwise, it will be stuck in Gaza and will create a lot of problems for itself and for its ally, the United States. So he was hoping to also convince the Israeli leadership to focus on what he perceives as important at this time, which is humanitarian support for Palestinian civilians. But I think, basically, I don't think he presented any genuine ideas. Usually, throwing money at people under occupation is not necessarily a favor to these people. Ending the occupation is. And that's why, essentially, Jordan, Egypt, and the Palestinians pulled out of the meeting in Amman, feeling that this would be, one, too embarrassing for them to be meeting with the president when his views have not evolved yet on this issue enough to justify the meeting. And so they did not essentially acquiesce to being a photo, you know, to engage in a photo op with the president to be used for his next election campaign.
And that was Khalil Jashan, executive director of the Arab Center in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The South African government says it could play a meaningful role in any future talks to end the conflict between Israel and Hamas. South Africa's governing African National Congress, or the ANC, has close relations with Hamas. Darren Taylor reports.
Soon after Nelson Mandela became South Africa's first democratically elected president in 1994, he declared, "Our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of Palestinians." Since then, the South African government has advocated for self-determination of Palestinians. It describes Israel as an apartheid state for what it calls racist oppression of Palestinians. In the past, the ANC has referred to Hamas, which was democratically elected and runs Gaza, as freedom fighters. The United States and several other governments have designated the group a terrorist organization. At a meeting of ANC leaders this week, President Cyril Ramaphosa criticized both sides.
The ANC NEC has condemned, in the strongest terms, the brutal killings of civilians by Hamas. The ANC also has been perturbed by the genocidal and atrocious activities of the State of Israel, which are being directed indiscriminately at Palestinian citizens shutting them off from all forms of livelihood.
It's language such as this, some critics say, that weigh against the South African government being involved in efforts to end the conflict, which began October 7 when Hamas militants attacked communities close to the Gaza border in Israel. The Israeli military responded by blockading Gaza, home to more than 2 million people, and bombarding it with missiles and airstrikes. John Stremlau, an international relations expert at Johannesburg's Wits University and former American diplomat, sees things differently. He told VOA that Ramaphosa's offer to try to broker peace is realistic.
If you're going to have a peace process, it is incumbent upon the Palestinians to feel they have a friend comparable to the United States support for Israel. And because South Africa and the United States have a very rich dialogue going about a bunch of issues that they may have differences on, I see a complementarity.
When Stremlau was a U.S. diplomat, he worked on Israeli-Palestinian affairs for past United States administrations. He doesn't think the Ramaphosa administration supports Hamas.
And they always referred the Palestinian people. Never is, especially is Hamas mentioned. The identification is with the Palestinian people and their aspirations for a homeland secure and home to all who live in it, including Muslims and Jews and Christians. Regional powers seem to want to have a peaceful resolution around the two-state solution that the King of Jordan endorsed. I think South Africa is positioning itself very well represent the interests of the Palestinian people.
Stremlau describes Ramaphosa as a highly skilled negotiator who helped end apartheid in South Africa and points to his role in securing the Good Friday Agreement that ended years of conflict in Ireland in 1998. Ramaphosa, along with former Finnish President Martti Ahtisaari, convinced the Irish Republican Army to lay down arms, and its former political wing, Sinn Féin, became a partner in Northern Ireland's government. So, says Stremlau, Ramaphosa knows how to talk with guerrilla fighters and to get them around tables with their enemies. But for successful talks to happen, says Stremlau, both Israel and Hamas would have to come up with reasonable leaders willing to abandon hardline positions. Many analysts think that's unlikely anytime soon. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
6 months into Sudan's conflict between the army and the rapid support forces, humanitarian agencies warn that the country is experiencing its worst hunger crisis ever. Lenny Kinzili, spokesperson for the World Food Programme in Sudan, tells VOA's Nabil Biajo that millions of Sudanese urgently require food assistance, but accessing them remains challenging due to ongoing fighting.
42% of the population, or 20 million people, are now facing acute hunger, do not know where their next meal could come from. And of those, 6.3 million people are in emergency levels of hunger, which is just one step away from famine. And the situation and the conflict as it continues and it spreads is only making the situation even worse. We're very concerned that agricultural productivity and the upcoming harvest season is at risk because of the impact of the conflict. And with lower harvest in the coming season, that could only further deepen Sudan's hunger crisis.
Before the conflict erupted in mid-April 2023, Sudan was already a country in debt, huge debt. Commodity prices were going up faster and higher than ordinary citizens can keep a pace with. Now the country has been at war for half a year. Let's go beyond the numbers a little bit. Paint me a picture of the daily struggle of families to put food on the table amid this rampant insecurity?
Well, no, because of the conflict, so many people have been displaced from their homes, have lost their livelihoods, their jobs. We are seeing 5.8 million people who have fled because of this conflict, 1.2 million of them to other countries. and the remaining 4.6 within Sudan. So, for example, there are families that ran away from Khartoum, ran away from this violence, and now are staying in different places, like, for example, in Shendi or in Atbara or in Port Sudan, where they don't have a home and they don't have a livelihood. And so they're really dependent on support. And that's why it's critical for aid agencies like WFP to be there to provide support. But beyond that, as you had mentioned, the prices continue to get higher and higher. The price of wheat flour today is 55% higher than it was a year ago. And we are looking at incredible rates of inflation, around 200%. Just in a matter of weeks, the Sudanese pound has gone from around 580 Sudanese pounds per dollar to almost 900. And this macroeconomic crisis, which already existed before the conflict, is just being exacerbated and pushing the entire country into a deeper crisis.
We know Khartoum and Darfur have been the epicenters of this fighting between the army and the rapid support forces. What are some of the hotspots of this hunger crisis in Sudan?
The hotspots of the hunger crisis are very much in the Darfurs. Even before the conflict started, West Darfur was among the most food insecure states in Sudan. We are seeing the highest levels of hunger in Khartoum, in Kordofan, and like I mentioned, in the Darfurs. And it's where the fighting is happening that the people are the most food insecure, but that also makes it the most difficult to reach because of the insecurity, because of the clashes and limited humanitarian access. And that is a really great concern for WFP, as if the people, especially those who are the 6.3 million people who are one step away from a famine, do not receive assistance, it will push them even further into hunger.
That's Lenny Kinzili, a WFP spokesperson for Sudan. She spoke with Nabil Biagio from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. European Union officials say member states must improve screening of migrants and asylum seekers and expel those deemed as security risks more quickly. Interior and Justice ministers met in Brussels in the aftermath of the deadly attacks in Belgium and France, and at a time of heightened security concerns linked to the Israeli-Hamas conflict. EU Immigration Commissioner Ylva Johansson told reporters it's important that those individuals that could cause a security threat to our citizens be returned forcefully and immediately. The 45-year-old Tunisian gunman who killed two Swedish football fans in Brussels on Monday was in the country illegally after his asylum request was denied. France's Interior Ministry said a 20-year-old Russian-born Islamist accused of fatally stabbing a teacher in northern France on Friday was known to be a possible security risk but could not be expelled under current legislation. There is also a new push for deals with African countries that would be similar to the one the EU has sealed with Tunisia, offering aid in exchange for Tunis, reducing departures for Europe. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokibilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrias Rigas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.